Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really shifting gears.
We definitely are.
Yeah, we're usually up in the clouds with these big theoretical concepts, but today we are heading down into the workshop. We are rolling up our sleeves and looking at a metal box.
This is a metal box.
Right, just a metal box. And I want to be really clear about this right off the top. For you listening, we are not just talking about scripting wires and screwing them into terminals today. We are talking about the invisible physics that keeps a building from burning down.
It is a massive distinction. And honestly, it's one that most people, even really eager, smart DIYers, completely miss.
Yeah.
There is, you know, wiring, which is basically just asking, does A connect to B? Does the light turn on when I flip the switch?
The basic stuff.
Exactly. And then there is protection engineering.
Protection engineering. Oh. I mean, it sounds like something you'd need a master's degree for, or at least a very expensive license.
Well, in a professional commercial setting, you absolutely do. But the mindset, the actual discipline of it, is something anyone can learn. And you should learn it if you're building these things. It's the difference between a system that functions for a week and a system that survives for 20 years.
Which brings us to our source materials for this deep dive. We're looking at a really compelling first-person field report from an experienced DIYer. He decided to upgrade the distribution panel for his metalworking shop.
And this is not a simple setup.
No. Looking at the specs in the notes, this wasn't just installing a couple of outlets for a glue gun or a soldering iron. This guy's running a serious corner.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a VFD-driven motor that's a variable frequency drive for those of you playing along at home, plus sensitive measuring instruments, compressors, and heavy inductive loads.
It's a really complex electrical environment, and what makes this deep dive so valuable, I think, is that the author is brutally honest about his failure.
He really is.
He admits he went in with that exact wiring mindset we just talked about. He just wanted to get power to the motor. And he realized very quickly that he needed an engineering mindset. He had to battle over current, surges, harmonics, and even something called the skin effect.
I really want to get to the skin effect later because it sounds like a biological horror movie.
It does.
But it's actually high-level physics. So our core mission today is to trace this journey from I built a box to I engineered a protection system.
And just a quick disclaimer before we get into the weeds here, while we are analyzing this person's educational journey and the physics behind it all, this isn't a substitute for your local electrical codes or a licensed electrician.
Right. Don't sue us.
Right. We are here to help you understand the why behind the safety rules, not to give you a permit to bypass them.
Absolutely. So let's set the scene. The author wants a cleaner setup. He wants his VFD, his power supplies, and his compressor, all running out of one neat, labeled, professional-looking enclosure.
Which is a great goal, but his initial design process was the standard trap that catches almost everyone.
The nameplate trap.
Yes. He looked at the nameplate on the device. Let's say the motor says it draws 10 amps, and he looked at the cable thickness chart. He thought, well, if the cable handles 10 amps and the breaker handles 10 amps, I'm safe.
Which, on the surface, feels entirely logical. If the sticker says 10, you plan for 10. Why is that such a mistake?
Because it completely ignores time and dynamics. He designed for a steady state.
Meaning when everything is just humming along perfectly.
Exactly. That perfect moment when everything is running smoothly. He completely ignored the violent reality of turning things on, the heat generation over time, and the actual quality of the power itself.
And this leads us to the first major mindset shift in the text, which is the definition of overcurrent. I think most people, you know, assume overcurrent just means too much power is flowing.
That's the big aha moment in his report. Overcurrent isn't a single thing. It's actually an umbrella term.
For a few different things, right?
Four distinct physical events. You have overload, short circuit, ground fault, and inrush. And the crucial part for you listening to understand is that you have to protect against them differently because they operate on completely different timescales.
The author actually includes a little quiz in his notes that he uses for apprentices. I want to throw it at you and to the listener.
Okay, let's hear it.
The question is, which is the least potentially damaging type of overcurrent? Is it A, a short circuit, or B, an overload?
It is a classic trick question. The answer is B, an overload.
Walk me through that. Because overload sounds like the system is being pushed past its absolute limit. Why is that less damaging than a short?
Think of an overload as a slow cooker.
Okay.
You are drawing maybe 20 or 30% more current than the system really wants. It creates thermal stress. Things get hot. The insulation starts to degrade or maybe discolor over hours or days.
It's slow burn?
Right. It damages the lifespan of the gear, sure. But a short circuit, that is a bomb going off.
So it's purely a speed issue.
It's an energy magnitude issue. A short circuit bypasses the load entirely. It releases a massive amount of energy in a fraction of a second. It causes magnetic forces that can physically whip cables around inside the walls.
Whipping cables?
Oh, yeah. And it melts copper instantly.
Wow. And this distinction really matters because the breaker, the actual plastic switch sitting in your panel, has to detect both of those, right? It's not just one single mechanism inside that little black box.
Correct. That's why a standard breaker has two mechanisms inside. There's a bimetallic strip, a thermal element that bends slowly as it heats up.
That handles the slow cooker overload.
Exactly. Then there's a magnetic coil that snaps instantly if it detects a massive spike. That handles the short circuit.
And this was where the author messed up his specific setup. He had a branch circuit feeding that motor drive, and he was so terrified of overheating his neat little box that he set his protection device incredibly tight.
He set the pickup the threshold where the breaker actually starts to care way too low. He forgot about inrush.
Inrush being the startup power.
Right. When you turn on a big power supply or a heavy motor, it doesn't just ramp up politely. It gulps a huge amount of power for a split second to magnetize the coils or charge the capacitors.
It's like trying to push a stalled car. You need a huge burst of energy to get it moving initially, but once it's rolling, it's easy.
That is a perfect analogy. And because he set the breaker to be too sensitive, every time he turned the machine on click, the power died.
He called it a nuisance trip in his notes, which kind of implies the breaker's just being annoying.
Right, but the breaker wasn't being a nuisance at all. It was doing exactly what he told it to do. He told it, if you see a spike, kill the power.
So the lesson here is that a bad setting can make a perfectly good device look defective.
That's a critical takeaway. You can buy the most expensive gear he mentions using industrial brands like Schneider and Siemens, but if you dial in the wrong settings, you've essentially broken your own system.
Protection engineering is about balance, then.
Yes. You have to protect the cable from melting, but you also have to allow the machine enough room to breathe during that startup gulp.
Okay, so let's say he figures out the overcurrent settings. The panel is running, the motor starts fine now, but then comes the thunderstorm.
Ah, the haunted panel incident.
Yeah. He writes that it wasn't even a direct lightning strike, just a bad storm nearby. Suddenly, displays are freezing up, tower supplies are resetting randomly, and the VFD is throwing all these alarm codes. But, and this is the weird part, the breakers never tripped.
And this is where the difference between current and voltage becomes a life or death situation for electronics.
Break that down.
Think of breakers like bouncers at a club. They stop the current from getting too big. But a surge is a massive spike in electrical pressure. That's voltage.
So the breaker's sitting there perfectly happy because the flow of electrons is low. Meanwhile, the electrical pressure has spiked to thousands of volts.
Precisely. And that extreme pressure blows right past the open breaker contacts and fries the delicate microchips in the VFD.
Because it's too fast.
Exactly. A breaker is a mechanical device. It is way too slow to stop a voltage transient that happens in microseconds. For that, you need a surge protective device, an SPD.
Which catches the voltage.
It's designed to clamp that voltage spike and dump it safely to the ground.
But here is the detail that really stuck out to me in his notes. He actually had an SPD. It was physically installed in the box. But he admits he messed up the installation because of lead length. He didn't trim the wires connecting it.
This is pure physics, and it is so often overlooked by DIYers. In the world of surges, things happen at incredibly high frequencies. At those speeds, a wire isn't just a simple conductor anymore. It actually becomes an inductor.
An inductor, so it creates resistance.
It creates impedance, which is a resistance to the change in flow. If you have long, looping, pretty wires connecting your surge protector, that extra length fights the rapid surge.
It acts like a choke point.
Exactly. The surge hits that wire, sees high impedance, and says, no thanks, I'll take the easier path, which unfortunately ends up being your expensive equipment.
So literally shortening the wire from 10 inches to 4 inches could determine if your workshop survives the storm.
It makes all the difference in the world. He had to go back, trim the leads, and make them straight and short to lower that impedance. It's a fantastic example of how neat wiring with nice loops isn't always engineered wiring.
Speaking of physical environment, let's talk about where this panel actually lives. He discusses insulation coordination. I'll be honest with you, I always thought CD ratings, like when you see Cat 3 or Cat 4 in a multimeter, were just marketing nonsense.
Like good, better, best.
Yeah, exactly. Like C4 is the pro version and CDO is the budget version.
That is the most dangerous common myth in electrical testing. The CDI rating actually refers to the electrical neighborhood you are physically standing in.
What do you mean by neighborhood?
Well, CAT4 is the service entrance. That's where the raw power comes off the street. The energy potential there is massive.
Yeah.
If a fault happens there, it's catastrophic. CT2, on the other hand, is a plug-in appliance in your living room.
So using a CAT2 meter in a CAT4 zone is like bringing a bicycle helmet to a war zone.
It's a grenade waiting to go off in your hand. The author realized he was using test gear rated for a quiet residential neighborhood in what was essentially a dangerous industrial zone.
And related to this neighborhood concept is something called creepage.
Ah, creepage versus clearance. This is vital for anyone building panels in a garage or a workshop.
Clearance is easy enough to picture. That's the air gap. If two wires aren't touching, they have clearance. But what is creepage?
Imagine a tiny ant walking along the surface of the plastic insulation from one exposed terminal to another. That physical distance the ant walks is the creepage distance.
Why does the ant's path matter to the electricity?
Because of dust and grime. The author's workshop is for metalworking. You have metallic dust in the air, maybe oil mist, massive humidity changes. Over time, that insulating plastic surface gets coated in a microscopic layer of grime.
And that grime becomes conductive.
Exactly.
So electricity can literally crawl across the dirty surface.
It can, and it will. If you routed your conductors too close together, ignoring the proper creepage distance, that dust bridge will eventually cause a short circuit or a flashover.
He realized he had routed things too tightly.
He did. He assumed the air gap was enough, completely forgetting that surfaces get dirty over time.
That's terrifying because you can't see it happening until it fails. It's just a ticking clock.
That is the very essence of protection engineering. You aren't building for today. You are anticipating the environment 2, 3, maybe 5 years down the line.
All right, let's move into part 3 of his journey. The panel is finally protected from surges. The dust spacing is managed. But then he adds the VFD, the variable frequency drive, and things get weird all over again.
The VFD. It is a miracle of modern engineering and an absolute nightmare for simple wiring.
He mentions symptoms like weird buzzing sounds in the enclosures, extra heating in just one specific wire, and crazy readings on his cheap multimeter.
Welcome to the world of harmonics.
Harmonics is one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot by audiophiles and engineers. What is actually physically happening to the power here?
Okay, so in a perfect world, AC electricity flows in a smooth, continuous sine wave. Picture a rolling ocean wave. But a VFD, or even a computer power supply, is what we call a nonlinear load.
Meaning?
It doesn't sip power smoothly. It gulps it in rapid, violent bites.
It's chomping the electricity.
Essentially, yes. It switches on and off thousands of times a second. That chomping distorts the wave shape. These distortions are the harmonics. They are basically high-frequency currents that ride on top of the main power wave.
And why does that create heat in the wires?
Because these harmonic currents are flowing through the copper, but they aren't doing any useful work for the motor. They are just wasted energy bouncing around. The source mentions that the author saw heating in conductors that shouldn't have been hot, based on his simple amp reading.
And this confused his meters too, right?
Yeah. Yes, and this is a huge trap for DIRs. Cheap multimeters are designed to read perfect, smooth sine waves. They take an average and do some simple math.
But the wave isn't smooth anymore.
Right. When you feed them a distorted, choppy wave from a VFD, the math breaks. They just guess. And they usually guess low. He thought his system was running cool, but his meter was flat out lying to him.
So if you were messing with VFDs, you need a specific type of meter to see the truth.
You need a true RMS meter. It's the only thing that can accurately measure the actual heat potential of a dirty, choppy wave.
Yeah.
If you don't see true RMS printed on the front, do not trust it around a VFD.
How did he actually fix the harmonic issue in the panel?
He had to treat the power quality itself. He used filters. Specifically, the source mentions moving from a noisy, raw setup to one with harmonic filters.
Which are components that smooth out those rough gulps.
Exactly. Passive filters use inductors and capacitors, while active filters inject countercurrents to cancel the noise out.
The data he provides in the source is pretty striking. He shows a before and after trend. Before filtering, he had high total harmonic distortion THD and frequent Nissus trips. After filtering, the trips almost vanished completely.
It connects right back to the main theme of his whole journey. You cannot separate protection from power quality. If your power quality is trash because of harmonics, your protection devices will act erratically. You can't just blame the breaker for tripping.
Now, this harmonic conversation leads right into what I think is the most complex but fascinating part of the deep dive, the skin effect.
Yes, this is usually something we talk about in radio towers or high-frequency transmission lines, not a metal box in a garage.
Exactly. So why is a DIR worrying about this?
Because of the harmonics we just discussed. Remember, harmonics are high-frequency distortions. Normally, with standard 60 hertz power, electricity uses the whole cross-section of the wire.
It flows through the middle and the outside evenly.
Right. Like water through a pipe. But as the frequency goes up, because of those harmonics, the physics changes. The magnetic fields generated by the current actually push the electrons away from the center of the wire.
It pushes them out.
Yes. The electricity starts to get crowded to the outside edges. It literally hugs the skin of the copper.
So the middle of the wire is basically dead space.
It becomes very expensive filler. It's not carrying any current. This effectively decreases the useful size of your wire, which increases the resistance. Higher resistance means more heat.
So you can look at a thick cable, think it can easily handle the load, but because of the harmonics and the skin effect, it's acting like a tiny, thin wire and overheating.
Correct. And the author poses a great conceptual prompt in his notes here. He asks his apprentices, what kind of circuits benefit from conductors with a large surface area?
And the answer isn't necessarily just thicker wire, right?
No, not at all. It's about geometry. You want surface area, not just bulk. Flat conductors, braided straps, wide bus bars, shapes that have a lot of skin.
That is wild to think about. It's not just about the amount of copper you buy. It's about the physical shape of the copper.
When you are dealing with VFDs and fast-switching electronics, geometry becomes a critical part of the engineering. He realized that for his grounding strap specifically, a flat woven braid managed that high-frequency energy so much better than a heavy round cable.
It really emphasizes that electricity is a physical force. It's not just numbers on a page or a schematic.
It is deeply physical.
So he's battled the overcurrent, the surges, the dirt, the harmonics, and the skin effect. Now comes the moment of truth, toning it all on for real.
Commissioning the system.
He admits he used to just improvise this part, flip the switch, and if it doesn't smoke, we're good to go. But he moved to a formal checklist.
And this is the true mark of a pro. He mentions three critical steps that I think everyone listening should memorize. First is the mechanical torque check.
Which sounds incredibly boring, just going around tightening screws. But he actually found a loose terminal doing this, didn't he?
He did. And here's why they loosen. It's not because he has ghosts in the panel. It's thermal cycling.
The expanding and contracting.
Exactly. When you run current through copper, it gets warm and expands. When you turn it off, it cools and shrinks. You do that 1,000 times, and the screw works itself loose. A loose terminal creates resistance. Resistance creates heat. And heat creates a fire.
So step two. Thermal inspection.
Don't just turn it on and walk away to get a coffee. Run it under a heavy load. Get the machine working hard. And then actually measure the temperature of the connections with a thermal camera or a probe. You cannot see heat with your naked eyes until it's literally melting the insulation.
And the third one, which I really liked, the 1 week rule.
Yes. Don't declare victory on day one. Some faults, like a slow thermal buildup or that dust tracking across the creepage distance we talked about, take time to manifest. He advises observing the system closely for a full week before closing it up and trusting it.
It's a patience game. And he notes that even though he used top-tier brands from the start, Fluke, ABB, Siemens, he still failed initially because the design was wrong.
That is the ultimate lesson of his whole project. A premium component cannot fix bad engineering.
Right.
A $1,000 Schneider breaker will fail to protect you if you set the dials wrong. A Fluke meter will give you dangerous data if you use it in the wrong category environment. You have to provide the intelligence. The components just provide the function.
So bringing this all together for you listening, the source material is really a story about respect. Respecting the hidden complexity of what looks like a simple gray box.
It absolutely is. He stopped treating these things as separate textbook chapters. In the real world, the harmonics heat the wire, which triggers the thermal overload, which might be exacerbated by a loose terminal. They all interact with each other constantly.
And his final advice to everyone is simple. Measure. Don't assume anything based on a sticker.
Design for the invisible. Design for the heat you can't see, the frequency you can't hear, and the surge that hasn't happened yet.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you, our listener, with a thought. We've been talking heavily about how modern devices, VFDs, LEDs, smart power supplies, make things infinitely more complex. They introduce harmonics. They are hypersensitive to surges.
Right.
We are all currently pushing for greener, smarter energy everywhere. But here is the question you have to wonder about. As we fill our homes and our workshops with these hyper-efficient smart devices, are we actually making our physical infrastructure more fragile?
That is a great paradox of modern electrical design. An old-school incandescent light bulb didn't care about harmonics. It didn't care about the skin effect. It was completely robust. Now, we have incredibly efficient systems, but they require a level of protection engineering that our old wiring and maybe your old DIY mindsets were never designed to handle.
Definitely something to think about the next time you plug in a smart charger or upgrade a tool.
That is it for this deep dive. Stay safe, check your connections, and we'll see you next time.
Measure twice, cut once. Goodbye.